Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Roland Barthes, in his autobiography, Roland Barthes and Roland Barthes, wrote, "What right does my present have to talk about my past? Doesn't my present have some advantage over my past?" This is something that museum directors, curators, educational instructors, writers, journalists, historians, and so on have to think about all the time, in each moment. And it's a question that we'll weave through this evening's discussion of a year that saw riots and public uprisings around the world, an explosion of the youth movement, civil rights movements, the feminist movement, astronauts landing or orbiting, the moon, and hair on Broadway, and much more. Here with me to discuss 1968, Kate Betts, head of education at the Bullock Texas State History Museum. Welcome, Kate. Big round of applause. Don't be shy. Don't be shy. You can clap. Margaret Cook, she is the deputy director at the Bullock. Welcome. Founding member of the Ruth Weingarten Foundation and author of Capital Women, Texas Female Legislators, Nancy Baker Jones, welcome. And the owner of Uptown Modern, Jean Heath, welcome very much. Welcome very much. So let's get started, Margaret, with the museum and the exhibit, the 1968 exhibit. Why 1968?
That's a really good question. One of the things that you see when you go into the exhibit is that it's arranged by month. And as you start approaching January, February, March, you'll see that the turbulence, the controversy, the conflict, the passion, the everything that was happening, not just in the world, but was actually landing into your living room, was having an impact on the escalation and the new voices that were coming out much more loudly and strongly for people. And for us at the Bullock, there's also some fantastic Texas connections. So it made sense for us to host this exhibit and look at where we've got recent memory sort of colliding with the memory of and the connections with artifacts and with the people that are coming to see it. And in Austin, it just makes even more sense, I think, because I still feel, as a newcomer, that this 1968 thread still runs through Austin today.
Yeah, and just walk us through the exhibit a little bit. What do you see as you walk in?
Sure. Now, you all have to come, right? Everybody's promising right now that you're all going to come and see the exhibit, because we have not just the 1968 exhibit in our Herstein Hall. We have When Austin Got Weird, if you haven't seen that, up in the Rotunda as well. But when you come into the exhibit, you realize right away that the first month you're encountering is January, and what hits you first is the sound. So you have the voice of Walter Cronkite reporting from Vietnam. But throughout that whole first area, you have the thunk, 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 thunk of the helicopter, the Huey helicopter, that is a sound that any Vietnam veteran is going to connect with right away. And there is, right in the living room with that you can sit in with Walter on the television, there is a sizable portion, shall I say, of a Huey helicopter that was put together in Austin. Every place that the exhibit goes to, the helicopter comes in pieces, and it's assembled with the aid of Vietnam veterans. And the Bullock was really privileged to have 9 veterans who were all involved with the Huey helicopter, either flying it, several were shot down flying it, or being ferried in it, to those who were actually training pilots here in Texas. So they put it together, and then when you get to February, you realize that February was one of the most brutal months in terms of casualties. And I don't know how many of you know this, but over 3,700 Vietnam veterans from Texas were killed, and the majority of them actually happened in 1968. So you kind of hit this turbulence and this sadness and this trauma, and through personal stories of the soldiers. And then next you get into the student movements that are coming out in protest of the war. So the exhibit takes you through all of this into the months where there were traumatic and heart-rending assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, and you go through, but we don't want you to get into the mindset this is just about tragedy and conflict and turbulence in 1968. There are three really fantastic lounges, places where visitors can pull back, take a breather from all of that, and look at design, look at pop culture. You start getting the Monkees theme in your head. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, right? And so you start hearing that in the background. That starts taking over the thunk, thunk, thunk of the helicopter. And as you move through, you get into the political scene. There were an enormous number of people running for president in 1968. It's astonishing to me. You get more into the women's movement. And then throw a little Fred Rogers in there. 1968 was the year that Fred Rogers went national. And the exhibit takes you through all of these moments, the backyard barbecue, listening to the All-Star Game on the radio. All-Star Game happened in Houston.
At the Astrodome.
Kate knows all this stuff. And then we end up on a hopeful note. We end up with two really incredible things. One is a music quiz. You can test your knowledge, and so you've got some great songs that trigger all of memories if you grew up in this time period or you just love having an oldies tune on the radio. But also December ends right around Christmas time with the Apollo 8 mission. And in your living room, instead of the Huey helicopter, is a replica of the Apollo 8 capsule, as well as several artifacts on loan from the Smithsonian Institution that were carried on that flight. And one of the most iconic images we have of Earth, it was taken on that flight, the Earth from Space, that is used even in our own third floor exhibit. So it is a month-by-month journey through a really incredible year.
And it really is. It's such an impressive collection of the bad, the good, and everything that kind of shapes your idea of what the 60s were as well. Kate, you're the head of education at the Bullock. Can you tell me a little bit about what you learned from this exhibit, putting it together?
Oh, wow. She got to do the tour. I have to do what I learned.
Head of education. Okay. Got to be fair.
So, what I learned about this exhibit is that it's a really interesting dynamic to have an exhibit in your space that some people lived through and some people didn't. So, we always talk at the museum with any of our exhibits about a chance for intergenerational learning and how can we tell stories to each other and about ourselves and about each other to help us understand ourselves better. This exhibit is a little bit different because some people aren't just looking at it like a textbook. Some people are looking at it like I had that in my living room. That is my living room.
Mrs. Beasley.
Right. So for Margaret, that's the Mrs. Beasley doll. I was walking through the exhibit yesterday and saw parents with a child who was maybe 15 or 16, and the father brought him over and pointed to a case and said, "Son, that's a TV guide." So just thinking through the things that everybody took for granted as material culture, the Yellow Submarine lunchbox, we were talking about Collins bags over before we started the program, just any number of, you know, the things that you had are what bring you in, and then the things that tell the larger stories you can keep talking about. It's really hard to start the conversation about Vietnam. It's really easy to start the conversation about a lunchbox. So there are a lot of places where you can begin that conversation together and then expand it into the subjects that are a little bit harder.
Yeah, and as we were talking before, we were talking a lot about, like, nobody really remembers this all the same way, but these do kind of trigger different ideas about your childhood or about, you know, when you had kids in the 60s or things like this. What I really find fascinating about this discussion, and Nancy, I asked you about this a little earlier, is kind of who is remembered out of this period and who is forgotten? And I think that's really pertinent to our discussion about the women's movement during the time. You studied a lot about women in Texas. Who are you missing, and who are we really missing from this time period?
Well, there are so many women that we don't know anything about. I was just thinking about the quote that you opened with, and it seems to me that if our past doesn't talk to our present, then we're not going to understand our future. So it's really important to make records of names of people that that you're not familiar with. And in terms of the women's movement, in 1968, it probably really got started in Austin, about 68 or 69, although there were a lot of things that were that had been going on around the country before that. But I think the first thing I want to say about the women's movement, what it was called then was the Women's Liberation Movement, was that what we tend to think of, most of our memories about it in terms of when women were taking their bras and their high-heeled shoes and throwing them in a trash can. That was mostly white middle-class women who were involved in that. But the women's liberation really had an effect on black women too, and Chicanas, Tejanas. But there was a different viewpoint or experience from which those women came. And whereas white women didn't have to fight racism, and sometimes, unfortunately, they were racist themselves towards other women. What black women and Chicanas often did was come from a community-based point of view. And so all of these women were interested in furthering their own abilities to become individual actors, and to figure out what it meant to be a woman in a patriarchal society and how to get rid of that and how to be able to operate independently and have some autonomy. But I think that there were some black women and Chicanas in particular who were a little more cognizant of the community they came from and working within that community and bringing the community along with them, as opposed to what a lot of women saw as white women saw as an opportunity to build themselves as individuals and to find themselves. And one of the great stories that I think exists about Austin at that time was that there were some women in the late 60s who were at UT, and they were members of the Student Democratic Society and probably worked for the RAG. And at that time, the RAG sometimes would publish pictures of nude women in order to boost its sales. And so one of these women's name was Sharon Colangelo, and she worked there, and it came her turn. Somebody said, okay, Susan, it's your turn to pose for this nude picture for the RAG. And she sat there for a minute, and it suddenly hit her. She didn't care that much about it, but she thought, why is it always women? And so she started asking the guys at the RAG, why don't you do it? And of course, that brought gales of laughter. But that kind of a question was what really began the process for a lot of women of saying, why is it these things are in place? And so she and I don't know, Marion Wizard and Alice Embry from Austin were involved in sit-ins at the Selective Service on campus, at the Selective Service and at the ROTC, and they started something called Gentle Thursday, which was, this was the anti-war part of it that women were getting involved in, and sort of from leftist politics, painting peace signs on the airplane that was out in front of the ROTC building and that kind of thing. But what women started doing also was holding consciousness-raising groups and trying to answer questions like the one that Sharon had asked about how come these kinds of systems and these kinds of ideas about women are in place. There were women that we don't know who, we don't know all their names, but who integrated essentially Texas A&M University in the 60s. That was really, really difficult. Some of them got threats to their safety. There was a woman named Vivian Howard who enrolled at Reagan High School in 1965. She was one of five black girls who enrolled there. She had a really difficult time. There was a woman named Holly Hogro Brooks who was at Texas State University. And at the time, in 1960, it was little more than an excuse for the University of Texas to say that they had a law school for human sweat. And so the kids at Texas State were feeling real self-conscious about their lower status in terms of education. And they got together, and most of this was led by young Black women there. They held a sit-in at a Woolworths in Houston in 1960, and that was the first time that it happened west of the Mississippi. So there are lots of women whose names we don't know that we deserve to know who were very brave at that time.
Yeah, and you brought up a really interesting point, which is these personal stories and how different they were depending on class, depending on race, depending on your level of income and these different things. As museum curators and educating the public about history and presenting this history, how do you negotiate these very private stories and these struggles with a collective idea of how we remember things?
Kate's like, ooh.
She's a curator.
It is done with as much sensitivity as we can. And I want to say, too, that there is a difference between curating recent memory, living memory, and curating ancient stories, ancient history, or even history from the, the 19th or early 20th century. The closer we get for exhibit development to very raw or honest or very different, diverse ideas and memories that people have when they go into a place, the more sensitive we have to be to it. And we try always to, when we're looking for the stories that we include, I can speak for the Bullock in this and for other museums that I've worked for, we try always to be as inclusive as possible. Now, that means that we have to gain the trust of the people that we are asking for artifacts from, especially in the Bullock's case. We don't have our own collections. Everything that's on the floor is on loan from somewhere else. So they have to trust us to care for not just their artifact, but for their memory and their own personal interpretation of that artifact. And then there's the curation of the interviews that we might do with people that help us craft the interpretation. And so we send out the most sensitive people that we can to gather those stories, and then we are careful about in our editing. You know, exhibit designers and curators will always say, an exhibit is a different kind of medium. It's not a classroom. It's not a film. It's probably closest to theater in some respects. And we know visitors in the gallery that we have 1968 in right now, unless we can really capture social experiences, they're probably only going to spend on average about 20 minutes in that space, which is really short, which means that you need to grab them as quickly as possible. And we're not necessarily there to tell the whole story, but we're there to, Kate alluded to it, trigger these social conversations that are happening. That's the best thing exhibits do, is inspire and elicit emotional connection with the visitors that are coming in. It's all for the visitors to share and create and have them be inspired or share their own stories, come back to us. We get comments all the time that's not just, hey, great exhibit, but, you know, my dad did X, Y, and Z, and I have his medal, and it means a lot to me. And those are the stories that make what we do, I think, worthwhile, so...
And we definitely would like to hear some of your questions and stories in a little bit when Amy comes around with the mic, so keep them in your head. But you mentioned that a lot of these exhibits and the displays trigger a memory, and they trigger kind of your idea of what the time period was like. And I know the first time I walked into the exhibit, the couch is what struck me, this green, long, flat couch, and also the macrame wall hanging. And I was like, is this my grandma's house? What's going on? And the television set and everything, I was totally shot back. And design during this period was really interesting. What, Jean, you've owned Uptown Modern for a while, but you've also been in the vintage furniture business for about 30 years. Talk a little bit about what the concept behind the design in the 60s was. Why were they designing the furniture the way they did, and why the style?
The 60s was a combination of styles. The really modernist style of the 50s was still very prominent in 60s furniture. especially toward the end of the decade, because a lot of the 50s furniture started out as commercial design and then morphed into more home design. The 50s style furniture, the real severe mid-century modern furniture, was very straight lined, very plain, very had a lot of had less ornamentation than in the past. So that kind of furniture was coming into home design. That's why you saw the long, low sofa, the very straight lines. Overlaid with that is beginning toward organic styles, especially in the late 60s. Organic furniture was very popular. We loved wood. Danish modern got to be very popular because people love the warm teak. It has orange and red undertones, and those tones really are reminiscent of organic feelings. And those two things were not necessarily the same, although a lot of Danish modern furniture is very straight-lined. It's a little more warm and kind of colorful in terms of the wood. A lot of the 50s furniture was used a lot of plastic and things that came out of the technological changes from World War II. Stainless steel, plastics, a lot of the rubber products that we saw in things like the Saran and Tulip tables, Bertoia chairs, which are the stainless steel wire chairs. We also saw here in Austin, Mediterranean furniture was very popular too, and I think that was because it was easy to produce and very popular for student apartments and that kind of thing.
What about the beanbag?
I don't know.
Who still has one? A beanbag.
I do.
Those are popular.
Where did those come from? Do you know where those came from?
I'm not sure, but they're really comfortable to sit in, and there are, I think, what, six or seven
there
in the
exhibit?
There are
at least four in every lounge, yeah. So come on down if you want to relive that experience.
But we will not help you get out of them. I don't have somebody in the gallery all the time to help you get out of the beanbag. Just want you to know that.
Comfort was very important at the time.
Yeah. So. And there's also, I really find it fascinating to look and see what's important in the living room, and you can tell that the television is very important. It's, you know, very ornate and cased very nicely, and then the furniture goes around that, and so a lot of it is to kind of serve the television. You know?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Part of the exhibit, I mean, not only is it divided by month, but in each month there's a timeline. So, yes, there's a particular subject focus, but beyond that, we're sort of recognizing that these subject focuses didn't stop in the month that they happened in that we're focusing on. So if you go to, there's a whole website that's been created for the exhibit as well, and almost every single entry on the timeline has a video associated with it, and that's really different than a lot of other time periods that you'd be able to do. You know, it's, you can pull 30 seconds from YouTube on almost anything now, and so many of them, whether it's sound footage or silent footage, have something visual to respond to. We were talking before about the soundscape in the exhibit. You know, Margaret talked about you start with the whoop, whoop, whoop of the helicopter, and you end with Walter, with his Vietnam commentary and then his commentary on Apollo 8. But along with that sound is just, we are bombarded by images of this time, and you realize how many of those images have become completely iconic because whether you live through it or not, you know what that image is, and so you know what it's going to be talking about from 50 feet away.
Yeah. One of the things that is really neat about the way the exhibit is designed is, for example, you come out of the month where Bobby Kennedy is assassinated, and there could have been news reports and newscasts and all sorts of different TV footage that was used for that. But instead, what you have before you is the visual, the images, just of people watching the train that carried his body to the cemetery. And you see it through this little window, and the sound is the sound of the train on the tracks, right? So whenever an exhibit is put together, we look at sort of the soundscape as well as the visual, because it's about getting all of your senses involved. And when you're talking about recent memory again, sound, smell, are some of the most provocative memory inducers that you could have, and it's a starting point for conversation.
Right. If we could put your teenager perfume in the exhibit, we would, because you would immediately take that visceral sense back and know where you were.
And why didn't you? I'm just curious.
Just kidding. We made bad choices as teenagers.
You know, I think that like one of the things at the exhibit, and also a lot of collective memory in the U.S. and a lot of popular memory, is it shapes the idea that this was happening in America, which we know that there was a lot of uprising in America, but this was a worldwide time of anti-establishment movements, student riots, protests, massacres all over the world. And it all kind of happened in this year in Mexico City and Paris and Rome. And I'm wondering, you know, as a historian, Nancy, perhaps you could speak to why were the 60s a time when that type of sentiment was emerging? Because there wasn't communication and pervasive media like there is today. So they weren't communicating directly.
That's just a huge question. And I don't know if I can do it justice.
I have faith in you, complete faith in you.
And I can speak better about the United States and the world, but it seems to me that this was a coalescing and sometimes a collapsing or a conflict of cultures of many kinds, not just gender, not just race, but age and views about what the world was supposed to be and the ideals that we had brought forward from the past, particularly our success in World War II and the economic success we had in the 50s. And then we have a war like Vietnam, and which affected not just the United States, but other people in the world as well. And so we were still dealing with the civil rights movement. And so there were a lot of human rights issues that were going on around the world, not just here. And I think that forms the core of it, trying to figure out who's in charge and who gets to say who their identity is and what happens when people believe that they deserve freedom and the ability to rise up and use their own voices, and they keep getting slapped down by somebody else. And you see that in particular here at the Democratic Convention in 1968, where this coalesces around the anti-war movement, and the Democratic Party platform decides that it's not going to pass an anti-war platform. And the kids weren't going to take it. And what happened when they started protesting was that the cops came out and beat the crap out of them. And so that kind of mirrors what was going on about, for me mostly, about the youth of the time being quite idealistic and saying, we're done with fascism, we're done with communism, we're even done with the corporate structure in the United States, you know, the militaristic structure that lied to us into the war. And I think that's where some of this comes from.
And this was really the first youth that had a teenage time, a teenage life, you know? I mean, it was, before that it was like you go directly to work in the fields or you go to war, you know? So that's also a really interesting time for just to be a teenager, which I think we take for granted now.
And on into college, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, speaking of college, there's also the GI Bill. So there are a lot more people from different classes going to college as well, which is fascinating. One thing I find also really interesting is how multiculturalism, you did touch upon it with the Mediterranean design, but how multiculturalism worked during this time. There's kind of an exoticism to a lot of the design. And I remember seeing a Brady Bunch exhibit one time where they went to Hawaii and they brought back all of these artifacts that were Hawaiian, and there's quite an exoticism. Can you talk about where that came from?
That's right. I think it did come from a lot of the travel that people were now able to afford. People traveled to Hawaii, to South America, brought back even Easter Islands, brought back a lot of the tiki look that was popular from the 50s and 60s. And we see it in the tiki bars, the tiki glasses. Those things are very collectible nowadays. Then people also traveled to Europe and saw the beautiful sculptural Danish design, brought that back, especially in the 60s. So just the whole idea of traveling more allowed people to bring back things from other cultures. We have a lot of wonderful Mediterranean design. It's not actually in favor right now, but because more of the straight line design is favorable right now. But we also have things from South America, Cuba, a lot of the Central American countries as well. Some of the archaeological artifacts were, especially in jewelry design. We have a lot of that too.
One thing that Mike Kurlansky, he wrote a book called 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. He argues that this was a time when people really felt that they had a voice. And they had time on television news, and people actually watched and paid attention to television news. But not only that, there was such an explosion of music. Talk about music and the artifacts that you have from that period in the exhibit.
Well, I think one of the things that, I'm the youngest of six kids, and we span 20 years, and from the 40s to the early 60s. And when I go into the exhibit, the music that I hear in it, it takes me back to, even if it wasn't, you know, somebody from my period, it just takes me back. And we've got the soundtracks for what came out, Star Trek, The Graduate, Rosemary's Baby.
In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night.
It was a huge year.
Yeah, just incredible soundtracks on the shows that are on TV, but then you've got incredible records that are being released. You've got Yoko Ono and...
And the White Album.
And the White Album. And Hair. And we actually, in the exhibit, have Jimi Hendrix and some of his clothing, which is kind of interesting because, you know, Jimi Hendrix was a trendsetter, right? His clothes for performances and in life and everything were really unique and out of the box, and people hadn't seen him on stage before, you know, he started appearing, and it was just incredible. And so we've got this purple jacket from him.
It's a beautiful purple velvet jacket. I would put it on right now.
Right. And I was thinking today when I was in the exhibit that it's really interesting. Here you've got Jimi Hendrix, iconic purple jacket, and kitty corner from him, you've got Mr. Rogers' sweater. And you know, two, they're just so connected, the clothing and the music, Mr. Rogers' theme song, so connected to identity and the presence that they were projecting. And so it's just this, music is the soundtrack to 1968.
Well, and you've also got Louis Armstrong and Tammy Wynette and... I didn't see Janice, but Barbara Streisand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk about different realms of music.
Exactly. And Aretha Franklin was on the cover of Time in 1968. And, you know, one thing I also would like to touch upon is the significance of the Cold War during this period. Because the Cold War, you know, a lot of identity and jazz and these... Even the civil rights movement was exported to Europe and other places to prove that the United States was a diverse place. And so identity was even more important during this critical period, which is fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because when you think about like a Cold War archetype, you think about patriotic America versus communism. And so even in this Cold War period, you've got the hawks and the traditional patriotic America, and you've got a very different America, which is still, you know, I want to take ownership of this, and this is what's happening, and I'm asserting my identity. Mr. Rogers is telling me that he likes me just the way I am. So yes, the Cold War's there, but there's even this internal American struggle of what does America look like? So it's not quite so cut and dry of Soviet, serious America, flag, beer, fried chicken, baseball, apple pie, thank you. I knew I was missing an important one.
Although some of the arguments that came from what the kids called the establishment were accusations that the kids were essentially communists. So they used it.
And really quick before we open it up to questions, there was the first African-American woman ran for president for the Communist Party in 1968. Can you talk a little, I saw the little poll there earlier. Can you talk about the political landscape during this time?
Well, I can tell you about the poll machine. So Margaret made reference to how many people ran in 68. And of course, the poll that we have in the exhibit shows anybody who expressed interest in running, not necessarily anybody who ended up on the ballot. So they reset the machine at every venue it's in. And in Austin right now, it's a dead heat between LBJ and Reagan. So that's interesting, because of course neither of them was on the ballot. If you take the people who are actually on the ballot, Nixon is in the lead. But when you look at the 1968 election results, Humphrey wasn't very far behind, but he has like 3% of what Nixon has in our overall voting. So I don't know, it's kind of an interesting, it's a really fun interactive, and it shows you the huge variety of where candidates were positioning themselves prior to this exhibit.
Yeah, you vote using a polling machine, voting machine, and with flipping the switches. We have verification as of this week that some of our volunteers have been stacking the deck.
So I think that's why LBJ's in the lead.
Yeah, could be.
Well, and in addition to Humphrey and Nixon, who couldn't be much different as candidates, you know, Humphrey billed himself as the politics of love and laughter, and Richard Nixon, who was as dark as they get. You've got also, what's his name, Wallace, from George Wallace, who's running, as well as...
Who manages to carry five Southern states.
Yes, carries five Southern states, and Eldridge Cleaver. It's a real interesting group.
Yeah. And sometimes we take for granted that the Republican Party is a conservative party, because when Richard Nixon chose Spiro Agnew, that kind of upset the party because he was so conservative.
Well, it's also interesting that Hubert Humphrey carried Texas. It wouldn't happen today.
Exactly. Well, let's open things up for a few questions. I know we have a few more things to talk about, including sports during this time, which is really fascinating. But Amy is going to come around with the Rover mic. Amy Chambliss. There's one right over here, Amy.
I'm from South Africa originally, and the anti-apartheid movement was on at that stage. And I have some inside information about the shenanigans that were going on at the time, which I won't go into now. But for me, one of the most interesting things of this period is the fact that the anti-war movement, I'm an artist, so from the art point of view, it created the conceptual art movement, which was anti-gallery, anti-museum, and people moved out of the field, and they refused to show in these places. They made art that people could not, you couldn't buy or sell, and that was one of the most important influences in the art world, and its reverberations come through right up until today. Okay, so I would like to talk to some of you about the story I have about apartheid and what I knew about it. I knew Nadine Gordimer, and we can talk about that at some stage. All right? Thank you.
You know, that's a fabulous point about art. Can you talk a little bit of the art in the exhibit as well?
Well, some of the art was actually recently commissioned by the Minnesota History Center for the exhibit, based on inspiration from artists of the time period. But you have everything that, you know, the kit art that actually, I will admit it, I did as a child. I had the little sand painting things, and you had the glitter and everything, and it's all, you know, follow the instructions and the dots and that, and you don't veer from it. And the macrame to, you know, really psychedelic, free-form things that can make your eyes, it would make any television screen kind of go a little wild these days. But you're absolutely right. There is this sort of anti-establishment that's permeating everything. At the same time, keeping the streamlined looks, the new products, the new kind of the original intention of art for the masses as opposed to art for the elite, keeping that moving and going, which is funny because it becomes highly collectible then, you know, later on, and now we're seeing that movement back to, again, art for the masses, I think.
That's interesting. Did anyone come out for last week's or the last Views and Brews on the Armadillo? The artwork there on the art posters is incredible. And you can see all of that also at the Bullock Museum, so you should check that out. Another question?
Well, I remember 1968 for a number of reasons. I was a kid in San Antonio, and I remember the alarm that my parents felt when Martin Luther King was assassinated, because they felt that he was so much into nonviolent protest that they were frightened by the fact that, you know, without his leadership, there might be a race war. I remember staying up as late as I could to listen to the one FM station in San Antonio that played long tracks because I wanted to hear Knights in White Satin, the full version. And instead hearing that Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, and I thought that it was a bad dream. And I was just absolutely devastated, and my parents didn't understand why. I remember seeing news broadcasts of the body count and young men being carried away on stretchers in Vietnam. And I also remember seeing Jimi Hendrix for the first time in 1968 in San Antonio. So the other thing, though, that I'm curious about, because I haven't heard it mentioned and we were a little late getting here, what about Janis? I mean, here we've got a Texas lady that somehow I managed to never get to see, but did you include Janis Joplin? And I guess I have two questions, because the other one was, how do you deal with those two pivotal assassinations?
So the exhibit was actually put together by the Minnesota History Center, and it's coming to us on one of its rotations, and because of the nature of artifacts, not all of them can be out all the time. So you and Austin get to see Jimi Hendrix's ensemble. If you were at other venues, you would see Janis Joplin's. So Margaret was mentioning earlier that as much as we would like exhibits to be a syllabus that exhaustively covers a time and a place like an academic book might, it's just not possible. So every exhibit makes those really tough choices, and so if you go see it at another venue, you would see Janis, and we would have loved to have her outfit.
Yeah, you would see the clothes. Now, she is represented in the album covers and in a couple of other places in the exhibit, and for the assassinations, I mean, we have two major ones, right, that were life-transforming, not just the political scene, but I think at a very personal level. For Martin Luther King, there is the assassination, but it's not the assassination that is the big event in the exhibit. It is excerpts from his speech, and it is conversations with people who were with him on the tour, on the journey, and describing how he was feeling at different points in time. And so that you get to have an insight in a way that you wouldn't in a book. You have an insight into him as a man and him as a leader. And with Bobby Kennedy, there is the photograph of taken of him in the arms of, you know, the closest person, as well as the camera that took that photograph, sitting in a case on top of the plate carts from the hotel. And then again, there is the being able to watch the images of the people who lined up along the train tracks as the casket went by, and hearing the sound of the train in the background. So I think that there is a recognition that for many people who lived through these experiences, there is a very personal memory, a connection to it, and pulling out, if you can even say, the best of really tragic and heartfelt emotion.
Right. I think it's in the exhibit, it's not about the assassinations themselves, because, you know, there's a very limited number of people who were there, but there are infinite numbers of people who remember how they found out and what coverage they watched and what they learned following. So each of them is much more about The lead up to, as Margaret said, you know, it's very, the speech that he gives the night before, that Martin Luther King gives before he's assassinated, is eerie because, I mean, he's essentially talking about how he knows he's going to die sometime. And so then it's about that, and it's about people reflecting on his legacy and who's going to take over. And Bobby Kennedy is, it's afterwards. There's a photo of it happening, but it's not talking about the hotel. It's not talking about the killing. It's talking about this void that is there after he is assassinated. So it's June. The convention comes up in the next few months. What's going to come in to fill that void?
And the exhibit also, you know, really speaks to the immense hope that people had around significant figures of history, and especially during this time. And there's also a changing sense of imagination of what is possible, like the idea of going to the moon, and also the fact that the Space Odyssey came out that year. I mean, there's just like, there's a real shift in public consciousness during this time that's palpable. And I think even when you say you were scared about losing Martin Luther King Jr. and what that might mean, that speaks to the power of that symbol at the time as well, or him as a symbol. Another question. Yes, right up here.
I was just wondering, I was lucky enough a couple of weeks ago to see the movie Eggshells, which is, I think, Tobe Hooper's first film. It was before he made The Chainsaw Massacre. And he filmed it here in Austin in 1970. And it was restored in the last couple of years. I wonder, it's a little later, obviously, but a really wonderful snapshot of a particular subset of hippies, really, living in Austin. It's not a narrative movie. I mean, it's kind of an early slacker in a way. Anyway, it's just a great window into that time. And it opened early in the movie is a scene of a Vietnam War protest that I think must have been real, because I don't think he had the money to stage something that elaborate. I wonder if, sometimes I think we are still in the midst of a backlash against a lot of what came out of the 60s and 70s, and the weirdness that was unleashed then. And I just wonder if you guys have any thoughts about that. Do you feel like it was almost too radical and too sudden, it was perceived as too radical and too sudden, a shift in so many things at once, that we still haven't really come to terms with it as a country?
I mean, I would say, I think that one thing that I saw in the timeline of the exhibit that really speaks to that is that Walter Cronkite spoke out against the Vietnam War on national television as a news figure. And to me, that just struck this chord that there is so much debate about neutrality in the news today and being unbiased and things like this. And there's such a plethora of news everywhere you go all the time that it's almost too much. But those words of honesty and truth were uniquely heard in the mass media during that time, and I think that that has been tampered down quite a bit.
I would say that there's a clip there from the Chicago convention where one of the reporters gets punched around. Dan Rather gets punched by some of the guys who are coming through the crowd, and you can hear Walter Cronkite said, "They look like thugs to me." Now that was a real honest gut level reaction, and he was saying exactly what he felt, which was totally out of character for what I, as I remember him, he was always just, you know, he was never emotional like that. And so what I think happened in the 60s was that there was some stuff that cracked open that people weren't allowed to talk about before. And part of that was about what a great country this was and how everybody was equal and how everything was wonderful here and everybody had limitless opportunities. And a lot of what happened in the 60s was saying that's not true. And we're angry about it. And I think that there are some people who haven't gotten over that. And I think that's why the word communist was tossed around about Martin Luther King, and a whole lot of kids and a lot of people who were considered radicals were considered traitors to the United States. And I'm afraid that there's a lot of that that's still in the air, but I'm not sure I could draw a straight line from there to here.
But there was an increase, or there was a difference in censorship after the 60s. You know, there are no more pictures of dead soldiers coming home, for example. And so...
Yeah, that was the first war that was really televised in a sense that you could see what was happening when somebody died. Yeah.
And we also saw, you know, out of that, the important role that television played in politics, for example, as well. You know, so there, I think that TV has learned a lot over the years.
You certainly can see the conservative movement, the conservative political movement didn't begin with Newt Gingrich. It was alive and well in the 60s and before, and Goldwater, yeah, in 64. I think that's why history is so important.
Another question?
It's partly personal. I was on the move myself, going from small town Texas to a city in Spain that year, but it's a fact that people were moving all over the place. People, you know, the ex-colonies, people were moving to Europe. Small town Europeans were going to the big cities from the farm or from the little towns. With that change, there was increased prosperity and also some psychologists talk about schizophrenia that comes from suddenly you're in a new place doing new things. There was also the prosperity. So movement and prosperity, does anybody have any thought?
My dad would have said, you know, me being an early child of the 60s, would have said that, you know, he didn't have time for any of the protests or and didn't have time to have his kids be part of that because he was working too hard to put food on the table. And so we were kind of lower middle class growing up, and I think that there was a perception among certain economic classes in the U.S. at least that the people who had time on their hands to protest were freeloaders and good for nothings. They ought to go out and get a job. You know, that sort of thing. I don't know how many of you heard that too, but I was hearing it in my own family at the time.
We heard it about the Occupy movement.
I think there's a lot of marginalization that happens, you know, with certain movements, and when you see people speak out, they're quickly, you know, marginalized as well, and you still see that like you did in the 60s. We have time for one more question. Yep.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Good, and I grew up in San Antonio, and I was graduating from high school in 68. So for me, it was a pivotal year of experiencing the first 5 months as a senior in high school, and then through the summer coming, going to college, starting college. So I saw a perspective of it as a teenager, 16, 17 years old. And that TV was a big part of it because that was the media outlet that we were exposed to. And being in San Antonio, there was not quite the radicalism that we saw in Berkeley, sit-ins, that we saw in Austin, but there was an undercurrent of it because there were several demonstrations. And then there was also the music. There were lots of musical venues that we went to. Sunken Garden Theater was in San Antonio, so there were rock concerts that we went to. And then starting college, I could see the Democratic National Convention and how that affected the freshmen in college because they could understand that there was the political movement of young people involved with that. So for me, the 68 was very pivotal, and it opened up a lot of things, I think, in a perspective of 67 being the summer of love in San Francisco. So there was a lot of youth movement. People were talking about people moving around. And then also the next year, 69, of men landing on the moon. So it was kind of a transition also of different things going on. And so I just wanted to iterate that it was very, very pivotal for me as well in growing up.
I love this. I want all of you who've shared stories tonight to go to the 1968 website, and there is a place to share your stories. You can also do it through the exhibit, but you know this is the example of a really great exhibit experience because you connected with 1968 and you felt in a safe enough place that you could share your stories. And I just want to thank you from the Bullock for that.
Well, also, thank you. Before we finish, I'd just like each of you to maybe comment on why it's important to look back at this time period, and then also the importance of thinking about the present moment from a historical perspective as well. I'll start with you, Kate.
So I became a parent 2 years ago, and I didn't believe everybody and what they said about kids. And it turns out that every cliche about parenthood is true. And so I would say that every cliche about history is true, too, because everybody says history repeats itself and then nobody wants to pay attention to that, but it's 100% true. So that's what I was rereading the text today, and there's quotes about how this generation is most dissociated from the values of the past than any other generation. And so you turn on the news and they're going to say that about millennials tomorrow, right? So I think in some ways, the particular historical moment doesn't even matter as much as the fact that people are people and there are these shared elements of humanity that are always going to be there. And so you can find your connection to one actor in the story, and that's going to bring you into the rest of the story and all of its complications.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we are human. We share human connections. And reflecting on our past and getting a little bit deeper into the stories, even if our memory doesn't quite jive with that, is really crucial for us to be and to have our children become critical thinkers. And I think that, you know, in 1888, they were saying, kids these days don't understand what's going on, right? That hasn't changed at all. Every generation has dealt with this. But for 68, you know, living memory, intergenerational conversations that you might not ever have in any other atmosphere can happen in this place.
Yeah, it's just critical for all of us to have a sense of our past so that we have some context for our present, because where we are now grew out of where we were, and where we're going is growing out of where we are right now. So if we don't know that, we're going to make lots more terrible mistakes. But we can learn so much from where we've been.
Well, I agree with all of that. Not much more to add. I just think that you were asking about the design and those kinds of things. In terms of what the past is, it repeats itself through design as well. I see furniture trends and design trends that were in the 50s coming and being very popular again today. So when we know about the past trends, it really helps inform us about what we're doing today.
Beautiful. Too much consensus, I must say. But well, thank you so much to Kate and Margaret, and also Nancy and Jean. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you to Elizabeth and all of you. Next week, we will have a Views and Brews on Wednesday with Jason Newlander. He'll be talking about the brand new phase of the intergalactic nemesis. So I hope you all can join us for that. And that's our only show in August, because the Cactus is closing down for a little bit in August so everybody can take a vacation. And then we'll start back up in the fall with a new Views and Brews schedule. So be sure to join us and check it out. And have a beautiful evening. Thank you for coming out. Make sure you go to the Bullock.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes Store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.